Welcome to Optimal Health for Busy Entrepreneurs, the podcast for busy and high-performing entrepreneurs and leaders who are looking to create more energy and optimize their health while upgrading their brain and personal performance with precision. I am your host, Julian Hayes II. I've been involved with health and performance for over a decade. This podcast was created for the high performer who is unapologetically ambitious, the one who moves at a fast pace and operates with an edge, the one who wants to become superhuman. Nothing here is fluff, gimmicky, or feel good. I have little to no interest in simply helping you improve your life. I want to help transform it. By listening to this podcast, expect to have a body that feels just as good as it looks. Expect to possess a swagger and style that gives off an infectious vibe. Expect to command the stage or any boardroom you walk into with your executive presence. And lastly, expect to become your most enhanced self so you can live a limitless life. Now, let's get to the show. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Optimal Health for Busy Entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Julian Hayes II. I am here with a fascinating entrepreneur, a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful lady who I'm grateful to have been connected with. She's a former federal prosecutor. She's a speaker. She's a coach. She's just a superwoman. She's an award-winning author. She has three books out, well, soon to be three books. The first one is The Magical Guide to Bliss, which is in my hand right here. I use this every morning so I can stay positive, don't get too dark. And the second one is Sparkle and Shine, which is another great book. And the next one that is coming out is Butterfly Awakens, a memoir of transformation through grief. Lastly, she is the host of Manifesting with Meg. So I'm here with none other than Meg Nocero. How are you doing?
Julian, I adore you. So I'm so happy to be here having this conversation because I know magical things always happen when people go into conversation with you. So I'm great. I couldn't be better.
This is awesome here. And I figured like you like to do, I opened the book and I saw what August 19th is, and it is Grateful for Connections. And I don't know how that works out, but I'm very grateful, you know, to know you. So I just thought that was very interesting how that works out.
Isn't it amazing? I love the synchronicities of everything. It's just fascinating to me.
Very much so. So I got to ask, what's the most exciting aspect of being a federal prosecutor?
Oh, wow. Okay. So one of the things that I loved most about being in that job was it's really the study of humans. I it's funny because I tell my daughter and my son all the time that, you know, I'm an actor because it's the greatest role I ever played in my life. But generally, you know, no one thinks about that, you know, the courtroom, right? And you have a role, and the prosecutor as the prosecutor, and then the judge, and the other side represents the respondent. But I always saw it as like, it's this, you know, stage and how things unfold and how exciting. And in addition, it's a study of humanity, right? How people respond to certain questions, how their body responds. I mean, that was always fascinating. I used to study body language, like just to understand when someone was going to lie to me or not, because there are certain tells in your body, like people cover their mouths, they lean back, they turn this way, they turn that way. So I tell my friends, don't be totally concerned, because I literally know what people's bodies speak before they actually say anything. But, you know, we don't actually pay attention to that on a daily, but in court, it's a good thing to do that because, you know, it helps you figure out what line of questioning is, especially as a cross-examination goes forward, you know how to go if you see someone like kind of hesitate a little bit or do something that would, you know, tell you something is being hidden underneath the words that they choose to speak. So I would say that was probably one of the most fascinating things. Certainly meeting a ton of people, also different people, and understanding their stories and listening to all these different storytellers, really, they are, was also something that's helped in the writing profession for sure.
Interesting. So I feel like this is like a power that can be wielded for good or evil. I just think about, you know, you learn that. And so I'm thinking like, if I really studied this, I can pretty much go out and I can know how everybody feels just by kind of studying, you know, when I'm interacting with them, I can just kind of have an inside track of you know, is this person telling the truth? How's this person doing today? What's their energy giving off? So do you sometimes catch yourself doing that?
You know, it's funny. I was with one of my very, very close friends, and she knows, you know, and she rubbed under her nose. She goes, this is nothing. This is, I just have an itch under my nose. So clearly I know people who are like a little bit paranoid around me, but this is true. It's, you know, I tell my kids all the time, I will use this power for good to protect you because I know what's coming at me. You know, sometimes, and you know this for a fact, because, you know, as we have habitually, you know, integrated certain behaviors into our lifestyle, certainly with regard to health, especially with regard to health, you know, after a while, it becomes very integrated into who we are. So the habits become good habits or bad habits, however you choose to see them. So, you know, the fact that I pay attention more so is something that I do. And I used to do it, intentionally or aware and consciously. Now I'm like, you know, it's funny because I'll just like maybe just not deal with the conversation. I'll move along. You know, it's like, oh, okay, I don't need, you know, especially with business relationships as well. You know, if someone is certainly trying to sell you, you know, the Brooklyn Bridge, let's say, you know, clearly, you know, that's not necessarily going to be the truth. So you just like, you know, it's not art, like, used to be very litigious for me because that was my job, but now it's just like, all right, let's just move along. You know, this is a waste of my time. Which, you know, in business, that might be the case. I don't generally do that in my personal relationships because I would have no friends and that would not be fun. So, you know,
it's very true. With that said, though, I think I do want to go, I might maybe not go buy some body language books. Now I just kind of want to like
to see like stuff. How your butt like so interestingly, like if you're going in for a big meeting, right? Mm-hmm. And the person is completely disengaged, leaning back, hands over their head, there might be a power dynamic going on because they're trying to gain one up on you, especially if it's a negotiation, right? Especially like maybe, you know, two people coming together on a contract. But if you see that and you can mimic their body language, it'll bring, watch what they do in response. Watch the response because you do it unconsciously. But and if suddenly is someone engaged in the conversation, like leaning in and looking at you in the eyes and seeing you, that they're really interested in what you have to say, you have your audience. They always say if you're a speaker, you always find that one person who's engaged, that you got them from the beginning, because it'll bolster the conversation. You'll get up on stage and it's a whole different experience for you. So the message is more confident, more assured, and more expertise-like, right? Because a lot of people question whether or not they have anything to say in this world. And then they're questioning, I shouldn't even be here. You know, who am I? Whatever. And if you find that one person who's like, I'm here to see you, and you meet them eye to eye, then it'll change the whole dynamic and energy of the conversation. It's fascinating. You should definitely go out. I'll even recommend you one after the show.
Okay. See, I wish I knew that about looking at the person who's interested, because a long time ago, I remember one of the talks I did, and I couldn't get out of my head the person who looked like they didn't want to be there at all. Ah. And I kept focused on that first. I was like, man, I must suck or something. I think I was talking about sleep. So I was like, man, this talk must be putting him to sleep or something.
Oh, how
he does not look
funny.
Like he wants to be here. So luckily I learned that and I didn't make that mistake. But I do remember during that time that he didn't look too interested. I still remember that guy's face. And so I think he had to be there because it was for a company. It was like corporate wellness and stuff. So, yeah.
But the reality is now that probably everyone wants you on the stage. They're like, it's like, I always say, go team Meg, team VIP Meg, we don't beg. But the reality is that they will bring you onto the stage because they want you there. Right. So that one person who's like not interested, who cares? You know, go find the ones that are, because there's going to be a whole plethora of those who want to hear what you have to say.
Absolutely. And so, now as we review the past a little bit. And so how do you go from federal prosecutor to what you're doing now? What led to that?
So, you know, once again, we pay attention to the different things that unfold around you. And you know, it's interesting because when I, my next book is about grief and the whole grieving process, because when I lost my mother, basically it set me into a real hole. Like I went down the depression rabbit hole. It was bad. It was anxiety, depression. I had the whole shebang. And that's how I wrote my magical guide. That's why I wrote my own guide to pull myself out of that. So I would follow, these insights that I would come up with every day as if my mother was channeling me this magic to keep me going. Like, you know, somehow, you know, instead of being covered by the dirt in the hole, I would use the dirt, like they say, to climb on top and get out again, right? So reality of the matter is, so how the processing was, you know, I was realizing that, you know, I was litigating cases for nearly 20 years and I didn't like it anymore. I didn't like people scared of me when I walked into court because, you know, I'm like very professional. Like while the, you know, it was recorded proceeding. So when the recording was on, it turned into trial attorney Meg. And when the recording was off, I would like literally turn to the judge, turn to the respondent sometime. And I said, listen, you put your parents here. They're dying behind you because of what you did. Are you going to take this as an opportunity to basically start? You're like, so off record, I was very different than I was on record. Not that I was, it was just a different component. Like, you know, you're on show, it's acting. And it really is, like, I say that with like, you know, clearly, you know, acting because it was my job and I did my job well. I chose to show up, be prepared, et cetera. But afterwards, my real self would come out. I'm like, can I address the, and there were many times where there was this one beautiful young lady, she was testifying for her mother. And afterwards, you know, when everything was done, the professional aside, I asked the respondent's attorney if I could say something to the girl. And I looked at her and I said, you at 13 years old did something that adults don't do. They get up and they speak for someone they love. Your truth in such a confident way, even through the fear. And I said, and I am so proud of you. I wanted to say that to her because the reason she was testifying was because, you know, she had been bullied. She had been destroyed by her peers. She had a hemangioma that was a port stain that was around her. Like, it was just, you know, I could see this child, but she had the courage to stand. So I when the recording was off, I don't know if it was appropriate or not. I never outstepped my bounds, but I felt like, okay, that's where I stand. That's what I want to be more of, you know, where people are like, oh, they're like terrified of me when I walk in. And then rather than, you know, I'm getting hugs from people, which I prefer, you know, at this stage in my life, literally to inspire and to bring them to another stage in their experience. And the experience was wonderful. I mean, I'm not going to berate it at any step of my, it helped me. It allowed me to be a better listener. Well, I will be quiet now and listen to your questions, but it also allowed me to articulate well those certain points in such a fashion that I would bring some content or value to the conversation rather than just talking away and just all about me, you know, really being in the part of a different kind of conversation.
So you were on stage with Oprah, right?
So that was actually the moment in time after like I had finished most of my insights for my book. And, you know, there's a whole long, you know, story around. I mean, everyone loves her. They don't love her. It doesn't matter. But for me, she was very inspiring for me. It was somebody that I could go listen to gain tips or advice or to live a better life, you know, because she was really like that curious person who was always on the search for content that would elevate rather than bring down. I think after a certain point, I think she speaks to that in her own journey. Anyway, so when Oprah, like, you know, was doing her show, I was like, I have to go meet her. But actually, at one point in time, everyone was like, this is the last year she's going to be on. It's almost impossible to get tickets to go. I wanted to prove to my mother that impossible things could happen when she was going through her chemo for her cancer and everything. So I was like, I'm going to make this happen and you're going to believe that impossible things can happen so you believe that you can get well, right? Mind, body, spirit, the whole shebang. Well, I actually even flew to Chicago to go see her on the last time she was doing her shows. I think it was October of 2010. Didn't get on. Anyway, this whole dream, this whole thing I was like claiming or clamoring onto did not come to fruition. The thing was, my mother passes away in April of 2011. Oprah goes off, you know, offline in May 2011. And I was like, my mother was my greatest inspiration, my champion, my mentor. She's gone. Oprah, another one who I looked up to, champion, mentor, she's gone. And I was like, well, what do I do now? Like, and then I was reeling into a very bad grieving process. So yes, that was the first part. Part two was I never gave up on the Oprah dream. I ended up going to, after a whole series of wonderful synchronicities, it's a whole wonderful story. I ended up going to American Airlines Arena, and this experience happens where Oprah pulls my friend up on stage. And then when my friend was on stage with Oprah, she goes, I can't be up here without my friend Meg. So Oprah calls me down, and I was like, it was like this incredibly awesome, surreal moment in time where something I thought maybe was impossible became possible. And I was up there, and all I kept thinking was, Meg, this is a huge sign. It's time. And she turns to me and she says, it's time to live the life you want. And I knew then that the life I wanted professionally was not what I was in fact doing. So I started changing my focus to realize what it was that I wanted. My purpose and calling was very different. And I realized that, you know, we only have this once around. As my mother said before she passed away, stress will kill you. You don't have regrets. You don't want regrets. And I just listened to that. And also with this incredible experience on stage with Oprah. And I was like, well, I guess I'm walking in a new direction. And interestingly, it goes to the point where I said, you know, at one point in time, I was like, too many doors were closing where I was. I was feeling pulled and called to step out of that box, because it is a very confined box. Government work, you have to, you know, chain of command, navigating the whole agency, you have to play within the parameters that what is in front of you. They don't let you really innovate too much outside of what is expected of you. And I was like, I'm ready for professional, you know, growth. I wanted growth, and I knew it couldn't be there. There were too many things, and you'll have to read my book more to find out what those things are. But the reality was, you know, it was time, and I was terrified. So I'm going to tell you, all of you out there listening, the jump was not easy. I was 20 years in a career where I thought I would retire from, and I thought I brought a lot of value to, and I only knew my identity there. So with those components, I was like, holy God, I'm going to jump out of this, not even know what the heck is waiting for me, and renegotiate with myself who I wanted to be and my why. So that was very fascinating. I think 4 years now since I've resigned in August of 2017, it's been 4 years now. And I can look back and say, okay, I'm further along the path. I'm definitely happy that I did what I did. It hasn't always been easy, but you know, one bit of advice is, you know, there's no failures if you keep getting up and doing it and keep trying again, right? So, you know, as long as you have breath in your body or life in your soul and a desire to see things come to fruition, keep walking.
Yeah. Did you, you know, I can imagine 20 years in a career, you know, I mean, my situation wasn't that hard. I mean, I was in school and I didn't have really any responsibilities but to take care of Julian. So it wasn't that hard. And I imagine, but your situation, you have a whole life established, right?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking like the second month or so, just those first 6 months after you took this leap, and you're probably still not 100% sure on what this new identity life's going to look like. How did you keep yourself sane during that initial period?
It's an interesting connotation. Like, it has like a, what is sane, right? Well, sanity, you know, is sane. Sanus in Latin is health, right? So how did I keep myself, I would say, healthy or mentally, mm-hmm. you know? You know, interestingly enough, I'm a very rebellious person at my core. I'm the middle child, you know, always, you know, caught myself doing things that my, you know, my parents did not want me to do, or march to my own beat, or, and I think, you know, the parameters that I had while I was working for the agency was, you know, basically, you know, punching a clock in, punching a clock out. I knew what was expected of me. I knew, and I was just like, screw all of this. I am going to march to my own beat. So I basically, first of all, I had to peruse through all the crap I brought back after 20 years of being at one place. You like just completely accumulate so much stuff. And I needed to like get rid of and purge some of that stuff because it weighs you down. So that was the first, you know, I felt like, you know, Marie Kondo would be like, you know, looking at me first as a hoarder and then, you know, okay, we're doing much better now. So I had to like get rid of that. But I think that was the process of like detoxing myself, you know, to a certain like, you know, do I take a break first? Okay, no, because what does that look like? Okay, my living room is entirely covered with my crap. So I have to figure out what do I need, what do I don't need. And then you know what I did? I just like kind of sat with myself for a bit. And I thought, okay, Meg, you are a complete doer. You don't sit ever. I was trying to think, okay, well, I had a strategic plan before I left. I got my credit, I mean, not accreditation, but it was actually my coaching. I started a coaching program. So I at least had some semblance of busyness that would keep me busy, you know, and I also had people who I could rely on for sounding boards because we all coach each other. We coach the coaches, right? So that was definitely a saving grace. But, you know, the what I'm going to do, the who I am, I had an identity crisis. Like, what am I going to do? Like, I can't say that this is my job. And like, you know, for so long, you know, it's so funny because when I had kids, and you can tell me to stop when you want me to, but when I had kids, I had always, you know, I was never part of anything really outside of work. I had a job. And because I had a job, the mothers who stayed home with their children didn't accept me. Mm-hmm. And the ones that I was at my job with who didn't have kids, they didn't accept me. So I was like, well, where the hell do I go? You know, I have this reality where children are a part of my life. I'm happy to have my children, you know. And then I just realized over time, okay, I just got to do myself. I just got to be me because obviously I'm never going to please anybody in these different circles. So if they want to be with me, can be with me. If they don't, they don't. And it's a little lonely at first to figure out, you know. It's a little lonely. I told you, you know, I still hadn't gotten out of the whole grieving spiral because what happened was I grieved my mother. I started doing these big moves and then I started grieving my job because 20 years in a job, you grieve what you wanted and what did not come to fruition too. So, you know, we humans are very complicated beings, but at our very simplest, I think that what I come to realize is that we want to be validated and we wanted to feel special. I didn't feel that there where I was. And now I was kind of like, I laugh. This is my analogy. You're gonna have a nice laugh at this. It's kind of like Disney World when you're on the Pirates of the Caribbean ride, right? You're riding, you know that you're on that track, right? And you know, the boat's never going to go off the track and it suddenly jumps the track, right? So you're like kind of floating through the Pirates of the Caribbean and all these things are coming at you, but you're not on the track anymore. So you have to figure out how to row yourself forward because nobody is doing it for you any longer, right? There's no punching a clock, punching out. You're not going along with the flow with everybody else who's on. You got on your own boat and you're floating around trying to figure out your way out of this maze of what we call life to find some light again, some clarity, which ultimately we do. And you sing yo-ho and you're all the way we go. You know, that's all good, but you still have to keep walking to get there and then find those magical moments, you know, that kind of, you know, tell you this is the right move. You did the right thing. And they're going to be there, you know, and one of the concepts I love is the something wonderful is always about to happen. So when we focus on that, then the unfolding can be even more exciting.
Yeah, and I'm curious about the grieving and how you started to write. The first book was The Magical Guide to Bliss, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, and because I think about myself, you know, with my father last year, and during that initial period, I didn't really feel like doing anything. I mean, I could go exercise, but that's kind of a point of just really exhausting myself so I can go to sleep, honestly. Yeah. And so how did you, like you're writing, you started to write this book while you're still grieving. How did you even like think of that idea to come do that?
Well, I definitely subscribe to the fact that when you're going through something really crappy in your life, you don't have to do it alone. And I was very lucky in the fact that I had a lot of people who wanted to help me. So one of the individuals who really was a pivotal point in my life when she invited me in and gave me her time, she's a therapist, and she had me sit down and she said, listen, Meg, you're feeling this completely lost experience right now because when people pass away, they're no longer here physically, but we can connect with them on a spiritual or a other level, right? So what she said to me, what do you love to do? And I love to write. So she said to me, you should sit down and have a conversation with your mother every day and ask her what you're struggling with and what you should do. So basically, it would be as if she were to channel the advice that she would give me to help me get through a situation that I was in because she left physically this earth. So that is what I did. I said, okay, I'm very good at taking direction for sure if it's going to help me and if it aligns with me. So she found, you know, for me, it was writing. For someone else, it could be singing. For someone else, it could be exercise. Whatever gets you connected to that voice inside, right? The internal voice where you don't feel so lost and alone. And that is what I did. Every morning I would wake up. I do appreciate exercise to the fact where I love stationary bicycling. Stationary bicycling is my go-to exercise. Peloton, I love that. But that's very different than stationary, because when I do with a station, so a lot of people do meditation on mala beads or rosaries, or they pray and it settles the mind. For me, and this may be aligned with you as well, when my body, when I feel the physical exertion, I don't think about the fidgety. I don't think about my, like, maybe ADHD. I have no idea. The act necessary to move, because my body's moving. I'm staying still, but I could write. Mm-hmm. So I wrote while my body was moving. So my body, like, so I had a, you know, for me, it was a twofold approach, you know, be still, but in a way that I needed, because I need to move, right? And then allow the opportunity to hear whatever it was I needed to hear. And if I needed some inspiration, I would allow myself guiding myself to a book, and I would read some of the book. I would get a quote and I would just go and I'd say, well, what do you want me to know from this? What do you need me to hear from this? So I feel like she's with me anytime I open up this book of mine, because literally she gave me all the tools that I needed in this life. She was there. It was at the end of her time. It was, you know, the end of her dash. And for me, at that end of her dash, I needed to start and really, truly live mine fuller, right? Without having those needs for someone else to tell me what to do, but to trust that I have everything I need and I know what to do and what's right for me in my life. So, you know, I
can relate to that. I can relate to that about, it's almost like you're, you know, saying, you know, there's no more, it's almost maybe like martial arts. And so I don't know if this is the right analogy, but I'm thinking like when you're learning from the master.
Yeah.
And then the master's like, there's no more I can teach you. You must go on your own now. And there's a song that I listen to when I run. It's when I remember when I was like 5 years old. It's one reason why I have a big dragon tattoo, is that there was a, I think it's called Barry Gordy's The Last Dragon. I saw it at my grandmother's house, right? And it has that concept in there where, you know, he's a kung fu master.
Oh, wow.
And his sensei tells him that there's no more I can teach you. You must go on your own now.
Wow.
And that's kind of what I think about when you think about when people pass away that are that close to us, is that there's no more that we can learn from them. And they taught us everything. And now it's for us to now go on our own.
I just got goosebumps. I love that. That's awesome. That is exactly how it is, right?
Yeah. And so I thought about that a little bit because I went back and started reading The Artist's Way and started doing morning pages again.
Love.
Because I've noticed for me, when I write by hand, it's a lot more therapeutic than when I'm writing and typing on a computer. Right. And I think because I can only write so fast.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the reason why. I don't know.
Well, there's an actual connection, right, between your nervous system and your handwriting. So, that's why people doodle. Like kids that doodle, they're trying to self-soothe. It's self-soothing. And also when you write like that, it's very cathartic because you're self-soothing. But you're self-soothing by allowing those thoughts that stay in your brain to come out through your hand, so that they no longer clutter your mind. So it can be, and the artist pages are beautiful at that. You know, I learned about the artist pages, the morning pages after I had already been doing this, and it made total sense, you know? Like, you know, fantastic, wake up, write, because what you do is, and they say this is a great tool for, you know, anyone who has a lot of things to do, mind dumping. It's a mind dump, so it doesn't clutter your mind, so that you're able to be free to see what else is out in the world, because you know that you've already somehow captured what has been haunting you or waiting to liberate you, right? That's awesome. I love that.
Yeah, because I looked at like this morning's, and I'm just like, I'm all over the place when I'm writing the three pages. It's just all over the place. And and she says not to really go back and read them and stuff. And so I might periodically, like maybe every month or so, go back and say, okay, what's been on my mind lately? Let me check this out. And usually there's themes, and those themes also show up in other areas of life too. And if I just slow myself down, because I like to just go as well. And so if I just slow down, I can kind of see the connection threads or things that I'm lacking, or I feel I'm lacking, and what am I seeking? Yeah. And so, but it took me a long time to like really do that kind of stuff, because I thought it was all airy fairy and stuff.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, the artist way, what she does do is say after the seventh week, go back and read, because what you're trying to do, because the artist way is all about rediscovering your inner creative, right? And it's there all the time. It's just that we don't pay attention because there's so much noise in the world and the chaos in our lives. So, and you know, I have no doubt in my mind that, you know, there's kernels of genius that come out of you. It's not, you may see it as just, you know, all over the place or whatever you want to, I don't know. But those themes are connected to something greater, some bigger calling that you can in fact use to enhance your life experience, which is only from you, because you're not looking to someone else to process this. This is all coming from you. And, you know, based upon your interactions, your experience with other people, and since you also do work with a lot of other people, you know, the beauty is the reminder that you've encaptured it in a way that you can use it for future reference, which I think is the beginnings of a very genius writer, which, you know, clearly you have many books and you already have one. So there's going to be more coming, I have a feeling.
So in due time, I'm bouncing a couple ideas at this moment.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah. Both the two Julians, I'm a Gemini. And so apparently there's two identities, I think. That's the Gemini thing, right? It's, you know, there's two personalities. So there's two personalities of Julian. And so there's two different book ideas, and each Julian wants to do one of those. So I have to decide which Julian is going to get the attention.
they say it's kind of like the two wolves, right? One good wolf, one bad wolf.
Yes, I love that story.
The two Julians. I'm not saying there's two bad, one bad, good Julian.
I love that story. The only thing about the good wolf and bad wolf is I think sometimes we need some of the bad, because that bad has the fire and the nastiness. But then sometimes you just, so I think it's finding the right ratio. Yeah. Because if I don't have the bad wolf or bad Julian come out, then the good one is just way too lackadaisical.
Well, you know, it's contrast, right? It's all contrast. We all need to have different contrast. You never truly understand how wonderful something is if you didn't go through the whole process of the challenges that brought you to where you are, right? There's all contrast. So you need the contrast to appreciate, right, to value what it is that you're experiencing in life for. And you can look back and say, God, you know, that really sucks. But my God, if it didn't happen, I wouldn't be where I am today. So there's value there. And I love the fact that I'm not saying that there's any, you know, evil Julian or.
There's an evil Julian. I think everyone has that in them. Everyone has I think everyone has evil in them. I think it's just like certain environments brings that out, almost like a recipe, like you're cooking something on the, you know, I think with certain ingredients, certain things fall into place, certain environments, certain things happen in life. I think anyone can become a supervillain.
Yeah,
I don't have any evidence to prove this, but I think that everyone, you know, just like with body language, like I can go use this for good, but then also I can also use it not so good things and to manipulate and that kind of stuff. So, you know, that's all.
Well, but, as long as you know the accountability quotient is there, right? At the end of the day, the karmic value of whatever you put out in the world, it will come back to you in one way or the other. You know, that's why integrity is such a valuable resource and that people shouldn't play with that. You know, I think that because, you know, trust is a valuable thing too. Once you lose it, it's hard to get it back, right? So, and that goes for all different respects, you know, of every kind of relationship you have. So, I think that the point of the matter is, yes, spoken like a true Gemini, Julian, for sure. Exactly. There is value in all the Julians who present themselves. But, you know, it's true. It's absolutely true.
Yeah. And, you know, when you speak about contrast, I couldn't help but think, you know, and I think this applies to like entrepreneurship, starting a business. I think it applies to careers. I think it applies to your health, is that, you know, I think about it and I think if I had like immediate success and I got everything I wanted, like within a year of just starting, you know, my whole endeavors, what I'm after. And I thought about like, man, that guy, I would have been buck wild. I would have been buck wild. That other Julian would have had a lot of fun because I didn't know how to manage those two Julians. And so, but then, like I said, I think it's maybe a quote or maybe somebody just wrote it. I don't know. So, no copyright things, but I think somebody said before you wouldn't know any hot if there's no cold, or you wouldn't know any pain if there was no pleasure, and you know, they just went a bunch of different contrasts. And so I think about that like, you know, and it goes back to the Buddha saying as well, as changing poison into medicine, but ultimately going through your grief, you know, if people are going through whatever hardships right now, that oftentimes can be an impetus for something really rich down the road, but it just kind of is not so good and pleasant in that moment, which leads me to the first section of your book, Butterfly Awakens, where you talk about grief, you talk about being a ground zone and entering this cocoon. So let's ground zero. What was ground zero and enter that cocoon for you?
You know, I had never contemplated losing my mother. It was not something, you know, and I had this childlike notion up until that point where, you know, I'm going to be okay as long as, you know, my parents are there. Right? Mm-hmm. They're there. I'll be fine. And I can do irresponsible things and nothing will come to get me because I like literally have my parents there. And I'm talking about like, you know, like anything that will, you know, kids don't die before parents. That, you know, not, that was always my childlike, you know, so my parents were going to be there. I'm good. My mom prays all the time for me, all the time for my sisters. I was good. And, you know, when I saw her so sick, it was kind of like, wow, this is mortality. It was really, really, really sobering at that point because I'm a real magical thinker in that, you know, I'm kind of like, you know, we can get through this. We're, you know, the mind is a very powerful thing. You know, let's grab onto something that's going to hold you through the, you know, necessary evil, the chemo. And that, so you'll come, so your body will respond differently. So that, you know, I was certain that, you know, the power of positive thinking, you know, the magic of belief, all of those things, the power of prayer, I was certain, and she was too. And what happened when I hit ground zero was I saw fear on her face for the first time in my life, and it scared me. It scared me because I saw her humanity, and at the same time, I was not about to start to grieve losing her when she still had breath in her body. So it was kind of like people are like, she's delusional, me being delusional, because I wouldn't let anyone speak negatively around my mother. And at the same time, having those first seeds planted that this might be her end.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, I don't know. You went through it too.
I was called delusional, but it was the opposite. So I knew mortality and I knew mortality since as a young kid. Cause I remember like uncles who went over to Vietnam and took their lives. And then one of them was also, relied on alcohol. And, you know, and just recently I thought about this, like, it was like, oh, so-and-so uncle is just crazy. He just gets to talk and do his thing. And then now that I think about it, I was like, wait a minute. This guy was talking about all the stuff that went on over there.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my goodness. And so I knew like real. So for me, I had to actually embrace a little more magical thinking because yeah. I was like, it was like a dark comic. Yeah. Like I was like, it was like, you take care of yourself or this is what's going to happen. And so for me also, I kept like researching to the very end. So I would say like probably part of my cocoon was feeling like I didn't know enough or I wasn't smart enough and I didn't like save. So, cause I think I had like a savior complex of like, I was supposed to, you know, save them and reverse this if I would have been smart enough because you're supposed to be a health person.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of self-attacks on myself. I didn't even like really blame like doctors and medical establishment because I kind of knew what was up with that. And I know the limits of that system. So for me,
yeah.
it was all just on myself. So I had to really wow. give myself. So for me, I had to really give myself a lot of grace and then start opening up to more like you call it magical thinking. I just call it just not being just so like dark.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you know, and so that's what, like I said, there's the mixture of two Julians, you know, there's one who just like, everything's just really dark and like, and there's no room for that magical thinking. And then the yeah. other one is there's a little more of an optimism. So it's like Batman and Superman if we're talking comics, you know?
I do love the fact that you keep referring to the you know, wonderful mythology of comics because it really does tell the truth of what people actually go through. I mean, it's so funny. It's not just for entertainment. There's actually a philosophy or mythology underneath lying, you know, that yeah. is exactly what you're speaking to, right?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know, Joseph Campbell, I think, made it popular with the hero's journey and the power of the myth. Is it? I think that's the name of the title, something like that. But basically, Joseph Campbell's books, really, you can yeah. read that book, and then you can look at almost every movie a lot of times.
Yeah.
And it follows that same linear yeah. structure.
Yeah.
And life's kind of like that as well.
Yeah.
It's just that, I guess this is an interesting question. Why do you think that some people don't progress out of the grief and just the hardship stage, and it sticks with them for the rest of their life? And this doesn't even mean,
yeah.
this is not even talking just about somebody passing away close to them. This can just be someone who loses their career or their first business doesn't succeed or they gain a bunch of weight and they just yeah. never recover from that. What do you think stops them?
So I think, you know, I've been told depression is sadness without hope, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people who get into that kind of rut of depression, you know, without hopelessness, the hopelessness is what kills a soul, right? That there's nothing that I can do that will ever get me out of this. So why do I try? And it can be a slow death. I mean, we all know that, you know, we all need something to live for, right? There needs to be maybe, you know, the follow your bliss connotation that Joseph Campbell speaks to in his hero's journey, you know. What is that thing that wakes you up in the morning and gets you going and says, this is what I want to do today. This is how I want to show up today. What makes me interesting and what things am I interested in? My why? So going back to your point, you know, we can all get knocked down. Like let me tell you that, you know, that's not the first time I've grieved in my life when I lost my mother, but it was certainly a big hit. That was a certain time that I didn't know I was going to be able to pull myself out. Certainly, I wasn't able to do it by myself. I needed help. And I'm very independent. I don't like to ask for help. And I generally think I can do everything by myself. But that was a point in time where to save myself from getting stuck like you're speaking to, I needed to reach out to other people who perhaps had tools to shift me. That being said, you know, I'm very blessed. I have a very good, strong family unit. And, you know, while they didn't understand my experience going through it, they didn't allow me to just wither away on the vine. Okay. So, I mean, I'm very blessed that way. I do think that, you know, at one point in time, I had to be vulnerable enough to ask for help, saying, this is not going well. I'm dying inside. I need someone to help me, not to do it for me, but to perhaps give me tools. And I did go to therapy, and some therapists would just talk therapy, went around in circles, and I always felt worse when I came out. And then there were the ones that gave me, like, I loved tapping. I didn't realize I would love, like, there's a butterfly pose that was self-soothing that, you know, they do for babies or for people who go through post-traumatic stress. You know, it's tapping. And you don't realize that your body, you know, on the physiological level will respond. But I have more tools now. So the evidence shows that if I use them, that even if I ever get back into a rut, which COVID, you know, threatened to do for a lot of us, for me too, I got a bit depressed. I never lost hope though, but this has been a very challenging 18 plus months. It's very kind of like looking into the, you know, you want to look into that glass in the future and say, when is this going to end so we can all start to live again? And the difference is that within the darkness, keep pulling out those places. And I showed you a lighthouse that you'll find the light. It's always there. You know, they always say that the cracks is where the light gets in, right? So when I would speak to someone who's going through a very challenging transition in life, or even gaining some weight that they don't want anymore, it's not over until it's over. You always have that opportunity to figure out. And I'm not into punishing. I think that is very, you have enough people who are going through challenges like that, they do enough to beat themselves up. You don't need someone, you know, literally you don't need someone else to do it, but you don't need yourself to do it. I mean, you know, I understand no pain, no gain, but at the same time, you know, there has to be some sense of acceptance where you are, right? I accept where I am. That's the only way that I can get up again and start moving forward. And there's a lot of freedom there, you know, okay, I screwed up. Okay, I did something stupid. Oh, I made a big mistake of my life. Oh, you know, from, you know, who knows, the small to the large, right? But, you know, I have to be able to forgive what I've done, take the profound, you know, moments of the past and say, but look what I've done right. And then refocus, reshift, and then give myself those little sparks of hope that build. I think that will become the big light, the big flame. So I don't believe in giving up. I think that is the stubborn streak in me that has always served me well, even though I found myself, and you'll see it in my book, in my closet crying for hours and hours when after I had to function and you know show the world that nothing was wrong, because God knows if you show the world something's wrong, then they're going to pigeonhole you or whatever, that I would go back in my safe place. That's another thing too. Find your safe places. There are people in your lives who can provide that safe space for you to truly be and who you are, show up as you are, but also say maybe when it's time, okay, it's time to move yourself forward a little bit, hold accountability to your path, and it's not over yet.
Yes. And, you know, speaking on hope and not giving up, I mean, I think you could take away everything. You can take away some everything, but I think the most critical thing that I think when you're truly defeated is when you have no hope and it's just apathy. I think that's probably the worst spot to be in, is in that moment. Yeah. Because I don't even think you feel it then. It's just blah. Someone's just like a zombie. There's no pulse, there's no life force flowing through. Right. But I think as long as you aren't at those stages, which you can still get out of those stages, it's just a lot of work.
You know, I don't know if you follow Tony Robbins. He believes in NLP, which is basically get in your face and scream, wake up, right? Wake up. Okay. That's too punishing for me. It would be feeling like someone's yelling at me, telling me that this is what I've caused myself, right? So for me, the whole wake up would be a different experience, so to speak, you know, but they do tell you, and I'll tell you, this is very interesting, Julian, you know, when you're at despondency, depression, whatever, there's this thing called emotional elevation charts. It's Abraham Hicks. They speak to this where, okay, so if you're depressed, and like, you know, someone does something and you get angry. We judge ourselves for being angry, but it takes you out of depression. Now you're wanting to move, right? You're pissed. Now you're alive again. Okay, so the fire is being, you know, churned, right? So you're no longer in your yoga pants on the middle of the floor, you know, face on the ground, you know, God only knows what you do there, right? But someone did something to you to the point to piss you off, which is like what Tony Robbins does with the NLP, that screams in your face. You'll have a trigger event. You'll be like, I don't know, scared, because it's terrifying to have a man that big yelling at you, or you'll get pissed off. Like, how freaking dare you yell at me? You know? So you'll start standing up for yourself. So it's those little tiny shifts in emotional experience, the feeling experience, that'll take you up your own elevation toward, because you're not going to jump from sadness to bliss in one day unless you're taking some kind of drug. And we all know that that's numbing out in and of itself, right? But what you can do is, those are the sparks. You know, I used to say when my mother had died, I said, will I ever laugh again? Well, don't jump to laughter. You know, I had to get pissed first. You know, I had to like go, yeah, I got to get mad. Like, oh my God, this is my life. What am I doing to myself? What are others doing to me? Even if it was like me being a victim before, I would have been like, I'm a victim. Oh my God. Well, I guess I'm mad because someone's putting me in these positions where I'm doing it. So it's that elevated experience of the emotional chart, the emotions, you know, that take you from despondency to something else. And, you know, how you process it is really a personal thing. But I always celebrate the moving forward. Even if someone's yelling back at me, it's fine because, okay, I got you up. You're awake now. Okay, yes. What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? Right?
Yeah, that's the thing I learned too when I you know, I went to therapy too afterwards. And, you know, I was telling her, she's like, you know, how are you doing after a few weeks? And I'm like, well, kind of a little angry, but, you know, I have good workouts because of it, you know, yeah. That's fantastic. You know, I'm boxing more and like I'm running more and lifting more. And so I guess I'm physically getting healthier, because during that time period toward the end, you know, I was 10 pounds. I was nearly 15 pounds lighter than what I am right now.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, I was pretty much emaciated, you know, like, it's like, are you eating now? You know, me being like nearly 180 pounds instead of nearly 200 pounds is a big deal. And so I tell her this and she's like, that's good. And I was like, well, you know, I'm angry. You know, I'm probably cussing a little more and stuff like that. Sometimes it's hard to focus, but I'm angry. She's like, that's good though, because you're not just in gym clothes today. So I know you're feeling better, because I worked with her before. She can kind of tell my moods by how I'm dressed.
Yeah.
And so she's like, you're not just in gym clothes. You're looking presentable today. You actually got a haircut. And it's okay. So I was like, okay. And she's like, the thing is though, you're doing something. You're not just sitting there now. So like the first few weeks when you're sitting there, you were just numb and just were sad and just despondent.
Yeah.
And now you're actually doing something, even if it's anger, because like anger puts things in motion.
Yeah.
And now if you swing the pendulum now, you'll go from maybe happiness a little bit, joy, back to anger, but you're not going to go from anger to just sadness. So you're actually moving forward, even if it doesn't feel like it.
Yeah. Which is incredible. You must have left there feeling great. I mean, like, oh, okay, I'm mad, but I'm okay. This is good. This is great.
Yeah, a little bit. But, you know, it takes, and I think, you know, each of us are different. I think for me, it's always been hard for me to celebrate just small wins, because I'm so results oriented. And so, you know, tying this to like entrepreneurship and business, it's hard sometimes on a day by day basis, which is why I really have to make sure I write down and journal, you know, small good things that happen, because I can get so focused on the big macro goal that I can feel like crap for a while because that goal is so far off. So, but I think this is where it comes down to identity and knowing yourself.
Yeah.
So for me, I kind of do respond well to a little yelling and like if somebody said something to me, like, because I'm used to like my, like coaches and stuff yelled at me. My dad sometimes showed me tough love. So I'm kind of good with that, because I know typically it's coming from a place of love.
Okay. I would be like, I would like do anything not to be yelled at, because literally that is how I grew up. Everyone yelling in the house, which is kind of interesting because that's how I deal with when I get mad. I'm like, all of you, just shut up. Just get out of here. Leave me alone. I don't want to hear it anymore. You know, it's what you're used to. Like the Italians literally are very loud. I'm an Italian. So like my family, very loud people. So people who are not used to that will probably freak out. You would probably be happy in my house. You would be like, oh, that sounds like my people.
Well, yeah, I'm used to, well, I always say this. I was, you know, and my friends still joke about this, that I was kind of a mute and I wasn't just as socially, you know, confident in as I am now. And so I had a lot of practice of being around a bunch of loud people. Yeah. And not really talking a lot. So being around loud people is okay. And so that's why, like I said, I don't really raise my voice that much, but I can be very potent with my words.
Yeah.
You know, so it's almost like for boxing fans out there, hopefully you're into boxing. You know, Floyd Mayweather, people don't like him as much in boxing because he doesn't really knock a lot of people out, but he never gets hit. And he's very – his counter attack in defensive game is very good. So – in a weird way, I hope this analogy makes sense. This is kind of how I am with like words and communication, is that I'm never going to be the loudest and I'm never just going to ramble on. But when I do talk and stuff, hopefully it's potent and very precise. So that's my random analogy of the conversation.
Well, I love how you said, you know yourself, right? To thine self be true, right? If you know yourself, at least the experience, like, I do appreciate who's in the room, and I do like to come out with some kind of entertaining notions that you come at least take something of inspiration out of the conversation. Mm-hmm. But to know, you know, to know themselves and to thine self be true, I can't be anyone else but me, or it definitely will be boring for everybody. You know, this is like, because it'll be boring to me. So, you know, the fact of the matter is the way in fact in which you fight a fight, you know, or dance your dance, or come across, like, I could never see you as a mute person. You have a whole platform here, and you're willing to, you know, share the knowledge that you've had over the years, but in such a way that's very aligned to who you are. And that's why people like who you are. You have an approach and a way and a, you know, that, you know, maybe, you know, drives people to the next level of their life because of who you are, rather than you imitating somebody that, you know, is clearly not with you.
Yeah. When I first started writing, I remember my first writings. I think that hopefully they got scrubbed off the internet. Maybe one day I'll try to find them. And I used to try to be, you know, I saw other like people in my industry and they were very witty and funny. And so I tried to emulate that type of writing. And I think all artists and creators do this at the very beginning. Yeah. They see somebody who has success and they're like, okay, this success, people seem to like this person. Let me write like this person. So everything I wrote was like jokes, and I would have a sentence and then I'll put a, you know, a parentheses to have another saying as if I'm saying hello, and then the side comment to go with it as well. And it was just terrible. But like, as you said, and as you said earlier, we have to go through those things so we can get to the other end and find our voice. And so I started to embrace of who I am. And I don't think you can ever be comfortable with your any situation until you grow through that yucky stage.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm still figuring out.
I'll tell you something very interesting. It's very, you know, law school, right? They break you down to the nub. They want to make you, you know, like Socratic method, scream at you. And, you know, you're always afraid that you're going to be on the spot because they like drill you for hours. And it's all like the habitual breakdown process of the way you think, right? To actually educate you to think like a lawyer. And the whole thing is how do you find your voice? Well, obviously I was aligned to that. So I went through that process. So I know how lawyers think. I know how lawyers speak, and I know how lawyers present. So, but at the same token, I still have to find who I am in the mix, right? Like who you are. And that's what ultimately, hopefully, you know, after all the drivel, right? The initial drivel, like you come out with your own personal genius, which is going to benefit so many people who are waiting to hear you and your brand of you.
Absolutely. And so this has been an awesome conversation. Anytime I talk to you, I feel like we could just talk for hours.
Like I said at the outset, I adore you. I think that you are definitely a bright light in this world. You're bringing a lot of good wisdom and content, and I definitely enjoy your energy for certain, and definitely you. You're great. I love you.
So I'm curious if you've even thought about this. What's the future hold?
What's
next? Have I thought about it? It's so funny because at this point, I had this whole strategic plan set out, finish what I started. And finishing what I started for me ultimately was, you know, I just got certified as a happiness trainer with HSA, which is Happiness Studies Academy, which kind of goes aligned with mm-hmm. my bliss mentality. And now my third book is coming out. The trilogy is complete. This whole long journey of 10 years, you know, is coming to fruition. So, you know, I'm a big faith over fear kind of girl, you know. I have so many tools in my arsenal now. How am I going to play with it? How am I going to use it? Right now, I'm kind of sitting in the magic of that, you know. I like you, look for the big hit for the enjoyment process, the accomplishment, the celebration. And I think on September 7th, when my book comes out, that is certainly going to be something that I'm going to intentionally sit and celebrate because I didn't give up. There are so many opportunities to do so. I walked my talk and I kept going. And, you know, my whole intention was to share the vulnerability of my story, give people a guide and tools because I wanted that for myself. And then at the end of the day, like start to pay attention where the lighthouse is leading me, you know, at the end of the day, because I don't know. I just know that, you know, this is where the path has led me this far. I get to meet incredible people like you, which I never would have had I been sitting in a court, you know, on Brickell Avenue over here. And it opened up my world to so many more incredible, imaginable, you know, people who have a way of looking at the world that's benefiting to me and benefiting people I contact because I learn from you and then I can share it as well in my world, which is the beautiful connectivity of life. So what happens next? You know, the sky is the limit for me. I just keep moving forward and being grateful as to all the opportunities that unfold, grateful for the people I meet. And, you know, it's like I say with my book, it's called Butterfly Awakens. You know, we have many different opportunities to experience metamorphosis in our lives, right? When we go through the caterpillar to cocoon to butterfly, there's many different ramifications of the same. Right now, this was the biggest transformation that I've experienced so far in my life. Have I done it perfectly? No, not at all. It's not been by far perfect. Ask the people who live with me on a daily basis. However, have I done it to the best of my ability? Absolutely. And I can say I still am very hopeful for what the future has to hold. More so than hope, I am excited. And I think that that's the difference between from where I was being that numb, right? I was numb. I didn't want to feel anymore. It was too painful to waking up to telling a different story for my life, more authentically me, unapologetically sometimes, to the dismay of some, but at the all, trying to bring my brand of joy into the world, of bliss, so to speak, and then, you know, making me a happier person, and hopefully the people that I meet a little happier, making a difference in their world too. So that's kind of what I'm going for right now. I love the creative process. I am so grateful to be amongst creatives now because, you know, you get to bring great content into this world to elevate it, which really at this time in our existence, once again, I'm sure this has happened in the past many times, but for all of us now in 2021, I mean, this is an important moment for all of us to shine, you know, doing our best to bring our light. So
absolutely. And, you know, that's a beautiful way to wrap this up. But where can listeners keep up with you and also pick up your book?
So my webpage is www.megnocero.com. I have to slow down a little bit. My book is on Amazon, bookshop.org, all the places where books are sold. I have a giveaway right now. If you pre-order the book, you enter the giveaway. I have a Butterfly and Bliss box where you get to win all three books and some wonderful swag in addition to that. So all you have to do is send to my email, megnocero@mac.com, proof of purchase, and you'll be entered into a giveaway that I'm picking on the day of my launch on September 7th, 2021. So if you buy it before on September 6th, send me the proof of the receipt, and then you'll get into my my giveaway. And yeah. And please contact me on my webpage. I'm all over social media. I have my Manifesting with Meg show. I had a great episode with Julian. He's fantastic. I had enjoyed basically adopting a lot of his tools for sure of how to manifest the magic and amazing in my life. And also I'm on YouTube as well as, you know, all podcasts.
So I will have all that in the show notes. Listeners out there, stay awesome, be limitless, and as always, go be superhuman. Peace.